This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
Philosophy Bites is made in association with the Institute of Philosophy.
When philosophers look back for inspiration to ancient Greece, it's normally to canonical figures such as Aristotle, Plato, and Socrates. They haven't in the past regarded the epic poems of Homer as worthy of philosophical examination. That, says Harvard's Sean Kelly, is a mistake.
Sean Kelly, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thanks for having me, Nigel.
We're going to talk about an unusual topic, Homer and philosophy. First of all, could you just explain who Homer was in very broad terms?
Well, of course, the first question is whether there was a Homer. The author whose name is usually attached to these famous ancient Greek epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey, is given the name Homer. By tradition, he was a blind poet who lived around the 8th century BC. But of course, nobody really knows whether there was a single person named Homer who put together these poems.
And why would he be of interest to philosophers?
Well, he's not typically of interest to philosophers. A standard story to tell about Homer is that he stands at the foundation of the history of the West. So he's of interest to literary scholars and classical scholars. And in a certain way, he's of interest to philosophers who are interested in the great arc of the history of the West. But a standard story to tell about Homer that people were very invested in, say, in the mid part of the 20th century, is that the real reason to think about Homer is that he's got a poor approximation of our much better understanding of what human beings are about and what we could be aiming at in living a life. And so they thought the reason to go read Homer was to get a sense for the ways in which he was wrong about the kinds of beings that we are.
So the characters that appear in Homer are either fighting each other or struggling against obstacles, in the case of Odysseus getting home, fighting various gods and beasts and monsters that get in the way. The characters aren't very reflective. They don't seem to have an inner life. They are just acting. They're not like the characters in a modern novel.
That's right. That's what struck a lot of classicists and philosophers. They thought the right thing to say about what kind of beings we are is that we are beings who can take responsibility for our action. This is a position that's a peculiarly modern position that was developed in a paradigmatic way in the late 18th century with the German philosopher Kant. And by the mid-20th century, it was at the center of our conception of the kind of being that we are. And Homer really doesn't have that story about what his great characters are. They're not characters who can reflect on their actions, can, in the paradigmatic cases, think very hard about what they ought to do, and then on the basis of some kind of rational calculus decide, or on the basis of some moral principle decide how to act. They do some of these things, but Homer doesn't seem so invested in that. So people have often thought that these characters are somehow primitive with respect to us. What I'm interested in, though, is the possibility that because they didn't have this modern philosophical conception of the kind of being that we are, they might actually have understood something important about options that are available to us in thinking about the kind of being that we are.
So I suppose what you're saying is that Homer actually might have been onto something, that he might have got a vision of humanity that we could learn from, not just as an early stage in the development of the modern psyche, but as somebody who had the insights into what a human being is now.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Nigel. So one of the things that a lot of people have been struck by is that the conception of human beings as beings that at their best take full responsibility for every choice that they make and take full responsibility for the actions that they perform, that conception, which is, I think, still a kind of modern conception, is incredibly demanding. A figure like Jean-Paul Sartre in the middle of the 20th century pulled out in a pretty clear form exactly how demanding this was. It's so demanding that everything you do is such that you're required to take full responsibility for it. You can't pass responsibility off to some authority. You can't pass responsibility off to God. You can't pass responsibility off to your neighbors or what one does in a situation. And if you really took that seriously, you would feel an enormous burden. But Homer doesn't have any of that. he's got a very different conception of what human beings could be at their best. And so one of the questions you might have in mind when you go back and read Homer is the question, does his conception of what we could be at our best allow us to slip out of this enormous burden that the full-on notion of responsibility that Kant gave us and that Sartre perfected puts upon us?
Are there key passages in Homer that are going to be paradigm cases of this attitude which will refresh our view of what it is to be human?
Yeah, there are a lot of passages. So he thinks, and his characters, his important characters will often say, that the best life is the life that recognizes an individual's dependence upon the gods. Homer had a whole pantheon of gods, the Olympic family that lived under Zeus and a variety of other gods. So the idea that all men need the gods, which comes up several times in the Odyssey, is an idea that I want to interpret in a very particular way. I don't think it means that if we're going to take something from Homer, we have to believe in the Olympic gods. But what it seems to mean for Homer is that when human beings find themselves at what he considers to be their best, they experience their activities as having a source that's not them. So it's just the opposite of the modern view, which requires that you experience yourself to be the source of your activities. In Homer's characters, many of the times when they're doing great things, Homer describes the activities as drawn out of them from a god. There's a place in book 3 or 4 of the Odyssey where Odysseus has been lost at sea for several weeks. 2 weeks he's been floating on a timber because his ship is shipwrecked. He's exhausted, he's hungry, he's thirsty. He finally comes into sight of land, but the land is ringed round with rocks. And so he's trying to figure out what he should do. Should he aim to go towards the land and run the risk of being smashed upon the rocks? Or should he aim to stay away from the land so that he doesn't get smashed upon the rocks but runs the risk of dying of thirst and hunger? And he's debating this with himself fruitlessly. He can't figure out. He's paralyzed by this debate. And I think Homer has the idea that often if you try to make a choice on your own in that way, really you'll just recognize this extraordinary burden. But what happens is that the wave sweeps him in and Athena put a thought into his head that he should reach out and grab the rocks now. And he does it, and amazingly, it saves him. And the idea that Athena put a thought into his head, I think, is just the idea that we're familiar with in certain modern circumstances, people who are really skilled at something, great athletes or great musicians or great performers or great rhetoricians, when they're at their best, they tend to describe their actions as not having themselves as their source. And I think that's what Homer's on to in this kind of case, where it must not have felt to Odysseus that the idea to reach out and grab the rock was his. It just was given to him by the situation, the way it is for a great soccer player when he finds the only pass that's possible.
The case you described is a bit like Buridan's ass, this famous, I guess it was a paradox, where you imagine this ass, the donkey, as it were, between two bales of hay, exactly the same distance from each, and because there's nothing to be said for going either way, it stays still and starves to death. That could be taken on your reading then, presumably, as a critique of a certain over-reflective approach to life. To live a good life involves just acting sometimes, not burdening ourselves with the reflection.
Yeah, that's right. If it's really true that what we ought to do is take responsibility for every action in the sense of having a good reason for doing it, and if it's also true that in certain cases there's really no good reason to prefer one action to any other, then quite a lot of the time we'll find ourselves in the position that Buridan's ass found itself in, the position of not having a good reason to choose one thing or another, and as a result feeling paralyzed. Homer seems to think that at our best, we don't find ourselves in that kind of situation. Rather, at our best, we experience actions as drawn out of us, and he describes that as the action being given to us by a god.
The trouble is, and you did use the sporting analogy there, that as we know from the behaviour of many sports players off the field, following strong passions, doing what appears to be the right thing because it feels right for you, can lead people into what I would think of as immoral behaviour. It's no guarantee that you're going to do something worthwhile because you feel that it's right for you.
That's exactly right. That's the threat that this kind of position faces. Let me give a different kind of example, which may seem to increase this threat, and then I'll try to use it to undermine the threat. One of the situations in which many of us feel as though actions are drawn out of us instead of being generated by us. I mean, many of us are not ourselves great athletes or great performers, and so maybe we don't experience it that way. But sometimes when you're watching a great performance, say you're watching a great pianist giving a performance of some rousing Beethoven sonata, and it ends on this extraordinary dominant chord, and then you find yourself rising to your feet with the rest of the crowd in enthusiasm, as we say. The moment in which you find yourself responding to the performance in that way is also a moment where you feel the activity drawn out of you. So I think we're familiar with the phenomenon, even if we're not ourselves great athletes or great performers. We can feel it in the response to something that a whole crowd of people recognizes as the manifestation of a certain kind of greatness. So that makes the phenomenon more familiar to many people, but it also may make it even more dangerous, because if the proposal is that we should find ourselves in crowds that are enthusiastically responding to something that they take to be great, well, we know that that can go very, very wrong.
Well, contagious emotion in the context of a Nuremberg rally is obviously something that we wouldn't want to advocate.
Yeah. That's exactly right. That's a great threat to the idea that we should aim at these situations where we experience activities to be drawn out of us. There are certainly situations where we don't want that to happen, and the Nuremberg rally is a canonical example of it. How do you deal with an example like this? How can you hold on to the thought that there's something right in Homer's idea that at our best we can experience activities as not having us as their source, while resisting the idea that we should aim at that in every case, including the case of the Nuremberg rallies? We need a distinction between the cases in which it's appropriate to allow yourself to be drawn into a situation like that, and the cases in which it's inappropriate to allow yourself to be drawn in. Developing that skill, the skill for recognizing the distinction between those, that's an important skill to recognize. I think that many of us have a version of it already. Many of us at least hope that had we been in the context of a Nuremberg rally, we could have turned around and walked away, recognized it as a situation that required that we not allow ourselves to be drawn into it. But you might think, well, geez, insofar as that's a hard skill to develop, maybe it would just be safer not to let yourself get in those situations at all. Never to let yourself be in the context of an enthusiastic crowd response to what it perceives to be greatness. The thing that I think is really important to recognize, however, is that there are situations where, had crowds not responded enthusiastically to, say, the rhetoric of a great speaker, important cultural changes for the better wouldn't have happened. The example that I have in mind is the example of Martin Luther King giving a speech in Washington that was really a speech to hundreds of thousands of people that solidified and helped to make progress in the civil rights movement. And had those hundreds of thousands of people not had the enthusiastic response that they did, not allowed themselves to be drawn into the rhetoric of Martin Luther King, but instead sat back deliberately and rationally and thought about what they ought to do, and then deliberately and rationally and coolly done it, it seems to me political progress wouldn't have happened. So we will lose important possibilities for cultural progress if we don't allow ourselves this possibility of responding enthusiastically in certain situations.
Are you saying that Homer is particularly good at describing the way human beings are, or is it that he's giving a model of how they ought to be?
Well, that's an important question. I think that he's got what you'd like to call a normative account. It's not just that he thinks people are this way. He thinks that at their best, human beings are properly characterized this way.
What is it that you're valuing here? Is it the fact that these actions are coming from a non-conscious source? We're not thinking these things through. Or is it that they're passionate actions, that they've got a lot of emotional, maybe physiological force within them?
I think it's not quite either of those. What I'm valuing is the certainty that one feels in the moment of that kind of activity. It's the certainty that's really interesting to me. We've already admitted that sometimes you could feel certain and be wrong. There needs to be a project of cultivating in yourself the skill for having this feeling of certainty when it's appropriate to and not when it's inappropriate to. But if you could do that, and I think Homer thinks that some of his heroes are capable of doing that, then it seems to me that you would be able to resist a threat that many in our contemporary age feel, which is the threat of not being able to recognize in many situations which action is more important than which. The threat of what Nietzsche called nihilism. I think that is a threat that we feel in the modern age, and that whatever its demerits, Homer's conception of human excellence doesn't have a lot of room for.
If we read Homer in the way that you've asked us to, we might end up with an intellectual understanding of humanity that's different. But how do you move from that into putting it into practice, to changing the way that you act?
That's a very hard question, and it's a very personal question. I think in a certain way, it releases you from a threat that I think I feel, that the only way to move forward in a life is to have a rational ground for the basis of all of your decisions. I find that a paralyzing kind of situation. Taking seriously this aspect of Homer has helped me to focus on other moments of my existence where that's not what's going on, and that I don't need to be threatened by the fact that that's not going on. I can find in certain kinds of enthusiastic and overwhelming situations with my children, for instance, where we're enjoying something extraordinarily and it just feels as though an activity is, you know, a kind of coordination of activity between us has happened through no planning and through no deliberation and has no rational ground. I don't have to be worried about the fact that it hasn't got any of that. I can enjoy it and I can recognize it as something that's worth aiming at.
Sean Kelly, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Nigel.
There's now a Philosophy Bites book published by Oxford University Press. For more information, go to www.philosophybites.com.
For more information about the Institute, go to www.philosophy.sas.ac.uk.